This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about the power that local, state, and federal governments have to seize private property and to use it for projects deemed to be in the public good. Projects like the interstate highway system, for instance. In Vermont, that enormous construction project began in the late 1950s and lasted 40 years. In Windham County alone, 340 properties and some 2,000 acres were seized. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to take a closer look at the history of eminent domain, how and when a government or a utility can use it, and what rights property owners have in the process. My guests are Sean Nolan. He's a professor at the Vermont Law School. He's also the author of the book Land in Conflict, Managing and Resolving Land Use Disputes, and attorney Jerry Tarrant. He's a partner in the law firm of Tarrant, Gillis, Miramam, and Richardson. He's also served as a special counsel for the Public Service Board and as a general counsel in the Department of Public Service in the past. Sean Nolan and attorney Tarrant, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to have you. So the roots of the legal concept of eminent domain go back centuries. Sean Nolan, can you explain the legal origins of the concept?
Sure. We need to sort of go back to our original concepts of property and where property comes from. If we look back toward England, anybody who had property had it. They were granted that right to use that property by the sovereign, by the king, and the king retained the right to take that property back. There were obvious reasons why that wasn't the best system of property, and as we moved through history, things like the Magna Carta and the U.S. Constitution put some restrictions on how government could take back property and strengthened the ability of private landowners to control and use their property. So what we see today in the U.S. Constitution is that government still has the right to take private property for public use, but if they do so, they must compensate the landowners.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit. Jerry Tarrant, when you look at the – just talking about compensating owners, how is that defined?
Well, it's defined – interestingly, it's defined in the statute as reasonable compensation. And if you're talking about a utility situation, then the Public Service Board or subsequently on appeal, the court would establish what would be compensation based upon the statutory standards. And in such a case, I think what you do is you go back to the statutes, and the statutes speak of the value of the property that's taken, the impairment to the residual property that's not taken but would be perhaps necessarily impacted, and then perhaps a third issue, which would be any consequential damages. For instance, if you had a business and you needed that land, you might have consequential damages to be included.
And when you talk about this being defined in the statute, we talked about what shows up in the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment. But Vermont statutes deal with these too. Is that what you're alluding to? Are there different explanations depending on if you're looking at federal laws versus state laws?
Yeah, if you go back to what Sean was referring to, it was the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that added the eminent domain clause. And interestingly, it's a very short clause. It just says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Those are the words.
When I read that, I was kind of surprised by the brevity there.
It's very brief. And if you compare it to the Vermont Constitution and the Vermont statutes, you see in the Vermont statutes and Constitution the need for a public use. The U.S. Constitution doesn't refer to the type of compensation. It just says – well, it does. It says just compensation. The Vermont laws break it out into how that just compensation should be determined.
Listeners, what part of eminent domain would you like clarified? Do you think that the concept is fair and that property owners are adequately compensated for the use of or the taking of their property? Or can you point to cases when eminent domain has been used unfairly? We'd love to hear your thoughts at 1-800-639-2211. Again, our phone number at Vermont Edition is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can check us out on the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your comments there. I'd like to talk about, you know, when we talk about the common good or projects where this might be used, I mentioned when we started the program the interstate highway system. Right now, the gas pipeline in Addison County may fall into the eminent domain category. What other types of situations or projects can or have been used with eminent domain? Sean Nolan.
So, you know, as Gary pointed out, that there's several different authorities that we have, that the government has to exercise its power of eminent domain. So the first is we look to the Constitution, right, the federal Constitution. Then we look to the state Constitution also. And the state Constitution in Vermont under Chapter 1, Article 2, allows for property to be private property to be taken for a public use. And then specifically the legislature, and so basically what that means, because it's in the Constitution, that means that the state has this inherent authority to use eminent domain. What they've done is the state legislature has also passed several statutes that specifically delegate that authority that's inherent to the state and delegate it to different agencies within the state. So they delegate it to municipal governments, municipal and county governments through Title 24. They delegate it to municipal authorities under Title 5 to basically expand airports and surface transportation. So essentially there are six statutes that delegate authority down to municipalities, counties, different state agencies. And the under these statutes, what's considered public use is, as I said, highways, airports, utilities, even flood prevention, watershed protection. And then we also know, if you're familiar with eminent domain, has applied in other situations, it also can be used for urban renewal, where a municipality wants to improve a certain area. And then it also can be used for recreational purposes. So a municipality, if they want to, they can condemn land along a scenic byway or a river if they want to build some type of a greenway there.
Well, I even read about a case back in the 1800s where a mill owner wanted to expand his operation, his business. And to do that, he needed to expand the dam that he used for power. And the court said, yes, you can do that, even though it would flood a neighbor upstream, because the expanded mill apparently would benefit the business and the surrounding community. And I found that surprising. Jerry Tarrant, when you look at a eminent domain used to improve a business, is that unusual, like a specific individual's business?
Yeah, that's unusual. I think the threshold in order to gain the right for eminent domain is that it has to be for a public use. And if you can't address that threshold issue adequately, you're not going to have eminent domain, because I think both the federal Constitution and the Vermont Constitution and the statutes that I'm aware of contemplate public use. Now, what public use means has been litigated, of course, and there have been many cases in, for instance, the utility field where the use has not always been in a person's backyard or town or even region, and in some cases not even in the state, that is, where electricity goes out of state. But the courts have allowed eminent domain if there is some public good within the state of Vermont.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about eminent domain on Vermont Edition. It's the power that governments and utilities have to seize private property for public good. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phone lines now and check in with Bill, who's calling from Hinesburg. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'll try to make this brief. This is an abuse, in my opinion. My family owns a farm in Orford, New Hampshire, with a 3,000-foot peak called Mount Cube. And my grandfather allowed the Appalachian Trail gave them permission to run the trail over a mountain. In 1987, we get a letter from the federal government stating they were taking 100 acres from us to protect the trail under eminent domain and compensated us, you know, $50,000. But, you know, I guess our point was, A, we were here first, we gave you permission, and B, being able to say, I own from my doorstep to the top of the mountain is a lot more valuable than saying I own from the doorstep to near the top of the mountain. So it's been abused much, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Sean Nolan, is that sort of a situation surprising where you've got a landowner that says, yeah, go ahead, you can use my property, and then subsequently gets a letter saying, well, we're going to make sure and use eminent domain?
Well, you could argue that maybe it is common because if you're looking at the Appalachian Trail, that runs from Georgia to Maine, so there's probably a lot of property that runs through, and
sure,
it might happen. You know, for every story of abuse, there's also a story of where it works out to the property owner's benefit. And I'm not saying that there is an abuse, but there's a lot of situations where this works out well. For example, a recent Supreme Court case, actually from last term, which wasn't dealing with eminent domain. It was the Koontz case, K-O-O-N-T-Z. And while it wasn't dealing with eminent domain, it was part of the story because what happened in the Koontz case was that in 1972, Mr. Koontz bought 15 acres of land down in Florida, which was right next to a highway. And about 10 years later in 1987, actually 15 years later in 1987, the state came and condemned 0.7 acres of the land and paid him about $400,000. So he bought the land for $95,000 in 72, and then the state 15 years later came and paid him $400,000.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's you know, we can relate to the caller's sentiment that this is an abuse because, you know, we own land and we want to have control over that land. And when the government comes in and takes that land, sometimes there is no compensation that we as the landowners can see as just.
A listener named Jennifer wrote in, please ask your guests to describe the legal standard for determining quote-unquote public good, as I'm sure most Vermonters would be shocked at what a low bar that is. Jerry Tarrant, what is the legal standard for public good?
Well, I think that depends on the type of use that you're referring to, but if I could go back to the utility situation, the public good situation would be determined under Section 248 of Title 30 of the Vermont statutes, where the Public Service Board first goes through whether or not the project is needed, and in that context, whether the need is outweighed by the public burden in terms of its impact to the environment, and so on. And in gaining that perspective, the board requires the company, the utility that wants to come in and condemn someone's property, to initially demonstrate that there's a need for the power or the gas or whatever it is, and certain other elements to it, whether there's a contract, whether there's someone who's going to receive it and receive a benefit, and whether there are alternatives. So they do have to go through that. What you see sometimes in these cases is that need has already been established in an earlier docket, and then
the Public Service Board.
By the Public Service Board, and then subsequently the landowners get a letter and they find out that they're the one where the pipeline or the transmission line or electric line is going through. And they have a different perspective on the need, and they say, "Well, we'll agree to the need, but we will object to the compensation or the fact that it has to go through our property." I think the real issue here is not necessarily whether a particular project is needed, but whether the line specifically, or the pipeline or the transmission line, has to go through a specific piece of property. That's a very difficult determination. And the question is whether it's a reasonable evaluation or whether there are no real valid alternatives to the utility company. And the Public Service Board has to grapple with that. And in doing that, they have hearings, and the Department of Public Service comes in and sometimes offers their perspective that there really aren't or there are alternatives.
And what recourse does the property owner have if they get that notice that, yep, this is the line that we need to take, and the property owner says, no, I want to appeal that?
Well, if they receive a petition that indicates that the company wants to go through their backyard, then they have the right through due process to appear and oppose that. They, of course, would have to put – this is where it becomes difficult because you have an individual usually against a utility company, and it's not always perceived to be fair, and it's a costly process. So the right comes with a significant burden, which is you have to bring your witnesses and you have to demonstrate that that this proposal either should not be in your backyard, or the cost that, or the price that they're proposing to pay you is unreasonably low.
And Ina, oh sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Sean. Go ahead.
What's happening here is that when the landowner is asking for a hearing, what they're asking for is the decision to be reviewed. And what the courts will do is they'll look to make sure that the commission made that the board made a good faith effort, and that they had adequate evidentiary basis for making that decision. And if they find those two things, that they were acting in good faith and they had adequate evidence, then the court is going to be very unlikely to substitute their judgment for that of the board, because that's not their job. And so that's where people talk about, it's hard to overcome the burden that's on landowners. Once the decision has been made, the judicial system will usually defer to the judgment of the board.
And here's the caveat, Nina. The good news for people who own property is contained in Title 30. And unlike most Public Service Board decisions that go automatically to the Vermont Supreme Court, the condemnation decision goes to Superior Court, and the property owner has the right to ask for a jury trial. So while Sean is correct that if it went to a court, and many of these cases simply go up to Superior Court and the judge hears it, and then it goes to Supreme Court. Recently, there was a transmission case that went to a jury trial, and the jury found a significant award for the landowners. And I think what that could indicate is that a jury could possibly, under certain circumstances, see these things a little bit differently.
Well, let me go to the phone lines. We've got a lot of folks that want to weigh in. Let's take a call from Brattleboro. Hi, Scott. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. When Vermont was settled, the first Vermonters chose to recognize the New Hampshire land grants over the New York land grants for the same land. And this was because of British land restrictions being imposed by the New Yorkers, and the freedom of land usage for the landowner given by the New Hampshire land grantors. This is what part of what Ethan Allen fought for, the Green Mountain Boys. And can you say that Vermont was founded on the principle of giving the control of land usage to the landowner, taking it away from the government? And does that leave Vermonters with a certain political responsibility towards this issue?
All right. Jerry Tarrant, I'll throw that to you for a brief answer.
Well, the Vermont Constitution states that private property ought to be subservient to public uses when necessity requires it. Nevertheless, whenever any person's property is taken for the use of the public, the owner ought to receive an equivalent in money. That's a quote. That's what the Constitution says. If you go back only to the time of our Revolution, you will see that the American colonies, as well as Britain, were taking property left and right without compensation. It wasn't until the Revolutionary War that England and the United States started looking at this idea of just compensation. I think it was an evolution. It evolved rapidly from the late 1700s into the early 1800s, and you started to see the understanding of the leaders of Britain and the United States that government sometimes needed to take land, but it had to be seldom, and when it was proven, it had to be just compensation. And I think what we're hearing from the people who are calling in or writing in is that it is an intrusion. It's no one would like this to happen to them. This is where you have constitutional rights and obligations versus private property rights and obligations that also share constitutional rights collide. And the Constitution attempted to resolve this in a way that allowed the decision makers to make sure that the need was there and that the compensation was proper. And I think the last item I would add as an individual is that this shouldn't happen often, but if it does, we have to be sure that there's a need for it and that the compensation is adequate.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to get to more of your calls and questions and continue our discussion on eminent domain. I'm Nina Keck, and this is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're talking about eminent domain, the power government and utilities sometimes wield when they need to use private property for projects deemed to be in the public good. My guests today are Sean Nolan. He's a Vermont Law School professor who specializes in dispute resolution and land use issues, and attorney Jerry Tarrant of the law firm Tarrant, Gillis, Merriman, and Richardson. You can join our discussion at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go back to the phone lines now. And talk to Peter. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question concerning property enrolled in the current use program. I live in Shoreham, and I'm not enrolled in current use, but I am charged a 15% surcharge for all the property owners who voluntarily enroll their property in current use and receive a generous tax reduction. So utility is a non-ag or forestry use of the land. Wouldn't that necessitate a vote in that town where the townspeople who are not to authorize this non-conforming use of the land?
Sean Nolan, how does eminent domain and current use overlap?
I honestly can't answer that question. What I will say is that, you know, as we've been talking about eminent domain, it's an inherent constitutional power of this state. And so a lot of times when you ask that question about whether or not this particular act of eminent domain is appropriate, you need to, as Jerry was pointing out, you need to really look at what entity is making that decision and exactly what use they are suggesting, because that will trigger one of the different statutes that's involved.
Jerry Tarrant, did you want to add anything?
Well, I think current use is a statewide program. It's a state legislature, and they promulgate the rules. They set out the statutes, and then I suppose, and I'm guessing here, that the Agency of Agriculture promulgates the rules to implement the current use.
All right. Well, let's go to Moncton now and check in with Maren. Hi, Maren. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I'm wondering if you can help define what is good faith negotiations and use of eminent domain as a last resort. When these are commonly used terms in the MOUs that are happening with the Vermont Gas. In Moncton, 2/3 of the homeowners have not come to an agreement with Vermont Gas and are now being threatened with eminent domain. And most of it revolves around the fact that we're not getting answers to our questions from Vermont Gas. They aren't flexible in the terms of the easement. They want us to sign damages releases. They will not compensate us for legal fees. They don't want to pay us until 30 days after we sign over any easements. And they actually have been negotiating options instead of easements, yet they're threatening eminent domain to 2/3 of the landowners. So can you help us understand what is a good faith negotiation and use of eminent domain as a last resort?
Maren, thanks for calling. Jerry Tarrant, talk about the negotiation element to all of this.
Yeah, I think it's almost a given that a utility, a regulated utility, before it comes knocking at the Public Service Board's door, has to enter into those kinds of discussions and negotiations. And so the question, what's good faith, is a fact question. Like many issues that end up before administrative bodies or the court system in this state, it's not always the statute or the Constitution, but actually how it's implemented by one party or another. And one of the most difficult parts about negotiation is that one or both parties, and sometimes there are many parties, and in this case, you can imagine with whether it's a transmission line for an electric company or a gas line, the line has to be somewhat straight. It can't zigzag too much. So there's some restrictions on the utility company. At the same time, I'm sympathetic to the caller, because it seems to me there's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's more than one way to go from point A to point B. And if a company, whatever it is, under whatever circumstances, only looks at one line, then the Public Service Board has to make a determination whether they actually in good faith looked at alternatives, whether they negotiated in good faith, and so on. So I think it's a fact issue, and I think that's when the landowners have to roll up their sleeves and contest it.
Sean Nolan. Yeah. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, just to respond to that also similarly, I don't know how the Vermont court states, the Vermont state courts would respond to determine whether or not a party has been negotiating in good faith. But I know that in other states, what courts typically do is that they look to whether or not the behavior would, you know, violate contract or tort law, and whether or not it would amount to a fraud or misrepresentation. And unfortunately for landowners, that's a very low bar that the agency or the state has to overcome in order to show good faith. So good faith is basically meaning, you know, they're not violating the law.
All right. Well, I think we have time for one or two more phone calls. Let's talk to Paul now. Hi there, Paul. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, this is Paul Bruja in Sutton. And the question I'd like to pitch to Jerry Tarrant, particularly because he's familiar with it, is the use of Section 248 for merchant generators, entrepreneurs, basically, that have been putting up the wind energy projects in Vermont. Those of us that are neighbors of these projects basically have had impacts, rather substantial impacts, to our property because of visual and aesthetic impacts, as well as noise impacts. And in most cases, some cases, our property values have been substantially reduced. And apparently Section 248 doesn't have the capacity to allow the use of eminent domain for these merchant generators, which appears to be a violation of due process clause of the Constitution in addition to the just compensation clause.
Well, let me throw that to Jerry Tarrant so he has time to answer it. What about this Section 248?
Well, I think we have to define what eminent domain and condemnation mean. We have to understand what 248 means. I don't think necessarily that condemnation doesn't apply under those circumstances. It may very well be that condemnation wasn't needed. I don't know what the facts were. But if a wind developer, for instance, needed to have a sub-transmission line down to a substation, and they couldn't buy the property, they would have to go through, or they would have to get the electric company to go through the condemnation process. I think what the caller is saying is that in many of these instances, these projects, whatever they might be, has an impact on the neighbor's property that takes away the full use of their property, and therefore they're contending that there's a taking. And so the first question is it a taking under the Constitution and under the case law that's been developed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court? And you see this not just with noise that goes over the boundary line so that you can't build, perhaps, because the noise levels are too high, But you see this also with septic issues, where a septic system may have drainage that affects the neighbor's property and restricts the neighbor's ability to use his or her property. You see this with respect to almost any kind of impact from any kind of use that resolves or ends up with some kind of residual impact to a neighbor. And many mm-hmm. times the neighbors feel that's a taking, and many times it isn't necessarily a taking. Sometimes it could be.
All right, listeners, lots of folks have written in on this subject, and you can see their comments at vpr.net/Vermont Edition, where this discussion will continue. Sean Nolan is a Vermont Law School professor and the author of the book Land in Conflict, Managing and Resolving Land Use Disputes, and attorney Jerry Tarrant is a partner in the law firm of Tarrant, Gillis, Merriman, and Richardson. He's also the former general counsel in the Department of Public Service. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the program today. I really appreciated your time.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Still to come, we'll talk with the author of a new book that looks at the history of New England from a surprising perspective. We'll tell you more about that when we come back. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Usually, when we study history, we look back at the leaders, the icons, the heroes, to understand the times gone by. But another way to study history is to look at the ne'er-do-wells, the criminals, and, well, the jerks. Matthew Mayo is the author of Jerks in New England History. He spoke with VPR's Sage Van Wing about his new book.
So let's start off with an easy one. What exactly qualifies someone as a jerk, in your opinion?
Well, I think that they have to have done something nefarious, usually at the expense of others. And often, I found in researching this book, those others were people who were near and dear to them. Oftentimes, family members took the brunt of the jerkiness. A lot of these people were just born with malicious intentions and just continued their downward spiral from there. Some of them grew into their jerkiness or jerkhood and made great fortunes out of it, and then eventually devolved. Some of them outgrew it later on.
Is being a jerk a timeless designation, or does it depend on the context of history?
I think in a general sense, it is timeless. If you're doing something that harms other people, and especially if you are aware that you're harming somebody else, then that's pretty timeless and has gone on for as long as people have been around. And I think it will continue to be that way. We're surrounded by jerks nowadays.
So tell me about some of Vermont's biggest jerks. Let's start off with, who was Bennett Young?
Bennett Young, he was an interesting fellow because, as I mentioned before, he was one of those people who, I think at heart he wasn't a jerk. He became a jerk for a period of time and then he outgrew it. In a nutshell, Lieutenant Bennett Young is responsible for spearheading the northernmost action of the Civil War, and it happened in downtown St. Albans. He was an eager 20-year-old soldier in the Confederate States Army. And in October 1864, with 20 of his fellow Confederate soldiers, in groups of twos and threes, they wandered on down from Canada into St. Albans. And on October 19th at 3 p.m., they assembled in St. Albans, and he climbed the steps of a hotel and shouted, "This city is now in the possession of the Confederate States of America." And that's really something that most people in St. Albans probably never expected to hear. And the reason they chose St. Albans is probably because St. Albans had three banks, and they robbed all those banks and stole $200,000. They made their way to Canada, and 14 were captured. But because Canada was neutral, they were freed.
So I suppose if you were on the Confederate side in that war, you would say, you know, here's a hero who was earning money for the cause, you know, not really such jerkish behavior.
Right. And the reason I ended up painting him with the jerk brush is because he caused so many people such strife for that particular day, people who never expected to be in the middle of the action. But St. Albans reconciled to the idea of it. And in 1911, when he was visiting Montreal, Bennett Young met with a group of folks from St. Albans, and they all had a cordial cup of tea at the Ritz-Carlton. So, yeah, in the end, Bennett Young was a good man, loyal to his cause, a hero to some, a scoundrel to others. I guess it all depends on which side of the war you were on.
Okay, so let's move on to another of Vermont's historical jerks. Tell me about Emmeline Meeker.
Probably one of the most unpleasant people I wrote about in the book. She was just horrible. A big bullying woman. She was nearly deaf. She was the wife of a farmer near Waterbury named Horace Meeker. And on April 23rd, 1880, she sent her 19-year-old son, dim-witted Alman, he was not the sharpest knife in the drawer, to the store for strychnine, allegedly because they had a rat problem. And she mixed it with sugar water and forced a 9-year-old girl who was in her care to drink it, while Alman drove them in a buggy out of town to a swamp. And on the way, the girl started to convulse and go through all the horrible contortions that one would go through in the throes of a strychnine event. And while she was screaming, Emmeline Meeker put her big hand over the girl's mouth and helped finish her off. And then by the time they got to the swamp, the girl was dead, of course. And Alman dragged her into the swamp and stuffed her down under the water and covered her with roots and branches. After a few days, the neighbors became suspicious of the little girl's absence. The little girl was named Alice. So the sheriff was called in, and he wore down Alman's resolve. He told him where the little girl was, and the sheriff waded in there and dragged the roots and branches off and reached down in there and pulled the little girl up. And then he made Alman hold her all the way back to town while the sheriff drove the buggy. And eventually they were both found guilty and sentenced to death. But just a few months before he was due to hang, Alman confessed in full, implicated his mother. But his mother never confessed. So on March 30th, 1883, after she bolted town a couple of big meals befitting her size, she was hung at the Vermont State Prison in Windsor. And that made her the first woman to be legally executed in Vermont.
And so jerk, in your mind, isn't a gendered word. You'd use it equally for men and for women?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think for some reason there are more male jerks in the world, but I think there are plenty of women who are not very nice.
So Vermont prides itself on its abolitionist history, but it turns out we also had a fairly strong eugenics movement. Tell me about Henry Perkins.
Yeah, Henry Perkins. Again, he was a lot like Bennett Young in that he had a cause that he just stridently believed in, but unfortunately it was not a good cause. From the late 1800s into the early 1900s, there was this pseudoscience known as eugenics. Basically, it's the promotion of racial purity through science. In the U.S., one of the biggest proponents of it was UVM zoology professor Dr. Henry Farnham Perkins. He considered himself an old stock Vermonter. He felt that his own research might help reduce what he considered mental deficiencies, and he wanted to cull those undesirable genetic traits that he found troubling in various groups of his fellow Vermonters. So he made great strides with the 1931 Vermont Sterilization Law. It said, in quote, a law for human betterment by voluntary sterilization.
And so which groups was he characterizing as deficient specifically?
Many, but in particular the French Canadians and Native Vermonters such as Abenaki Indians. But the Abenaki were the hardest hit of all the targeted racial groups. Many of them were forced to move from Vermont. They changed their names, adopted low-profile lives.
Do we have any numbers on how many people were affected, were forcibly sterilized?
Yeah, we had official records claim 200 to 300 cases of sterilization in Vermont. And that's a modest figure by national standards, but anecdotal evidence suggests that figure is substantially higher, perhaps in the thousands. Not a legacy to be proud of, certainly.
I guess I'd say that in my own mind, at least, Henry Perkins seems like the most jerkish of these three characters. Is that just my own bias? Or
It's possible that he is the jerkiest, because, gosh, it's just not that long ago. It seems like somebody who's that educated should know better. But yeah, so I would say he's right up there, the top of the jerk pile.
So another of the jerks that you included in your book is Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Is that really a fair characterization?
Well, probably not. But I thought it would be fun to do because so many people throughout New England have been affected by Mother Nature and her fickle ways, and will continue to be, even more so lately, it seems, than ever. And there's such, if they can be great stories, such tragic stories, such brutal stories of storms and hurricanes, just the horrible weather events, as they call them, that I felt compelled to put them in because I think, my word, it never seems to stop. So that's pretty darn jerky, in my opinion.
What's the benefit of looking at jerks at all? What do they tell us about history?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned from studying the scoundrels in history, not just the heroes. Why do we all like to watch murder mysteries on TV or read about serial killers, things like that? It's because we all like to flip over rocks and see the stuff that squirms underneath there, I think. I know I do. I hope that doesn't make me too jerky.
Matthew Mayo is the author of the new book, Jerks in New England History. I think I have to read that. And you can find a link to it on his website at vpr.net. If you're really tired of snow by now, and many of us are, you might want to consider making the best of it with a walk in the woods. With a little bit of knowledge and a lot of attention, the snow-covered forest can open a window into the lives of wild animals that are all around us but seldom seen. Lynn Levine is a forester from Dummerston and the author of a hands-on tracking book called Animal Tracks and Scat. She often leads tracking workshops for schools and nature centers and other groups. VPR's Susan Keese tagged along on one of those recent outings, and she sent us this report.
The snow is icy and thin after a series of thaws and freezes, so we leave our snowshoes behind. We're barely off the access road when Levine crouches over two tiny dotted lines running parallel over the snow.
I love these tracks. What do you see when you look at it?
A woman in the group makes a little hopping sound.
Okay, great. What happens to the tracks?
Someone answers that the tracks end suddenly, just short of a fallen tree. Levine says that's a sign that the animal lives underground.
So this is a shrew, which is the smallest mammal. It's so tiny. This is all melted. So anything that we're looking at looks much bigger than it actually is.
Even when the footprints themselves aren't clear, Levine says there's often other evidence that shows how the animal moved and behaved. Farther into the woods, we see a path that's worn almost smooth from repeated use. We follow it for a while until we find a few unmistakable hoof prints.
Looks like a deer. Looks like a deer. Exactly.
A pile of pellet-shaped deer scat nearby provides further evidence. Levine points out some oak saplings with ragged, chewed-off tops, the work of browsing deer, she tells us. A little farther on, we see another heavily used trail. The tracks within it are about the size of a deer's, but this animal has toes, and the edges of the path are wavy. Levine says that's a clue that the animal moved from side to side when it walked.
It's waddling.
Oh. I'm going to follow this track a little bit.
The trail leads down a steep decline and up again to an opening in some rocks where the tracks disappear.
Okay, here's the clue. What do you think the chances are that the deer went underneath there? So, this is a porcupine trail.
Oh.
Someone notices broken hemlock branches strewn around on the snow.
It looks like someone has destroyed the hemlock tree. What does that tell you?
Porcupines live in the trees. They eat the tips of the branches. They go from tree to tree, and they go to caves, and they leave lots of scat there.
Levine has never seen a porcupine in a tree. She says she rarely sees the animals that are here, even though her work as a forester takes her into the woods almost every day.
I make too much noise. I might see deer, but I don't see bobcat, and I don't see fisher, and I don't see fox, but I follow their tracks, and I know they're there.
Later, we find a good-sized pile of droppings. Levine pokes at it with a stick and finds hair inside, the sign of a meat eater. Levine says the scat's size and shape suggest a coyote. Looking around, she spies some faint, fairly old coyote tracks. She points out the characteristic X or cross mark in each footprint.
Well, that tells me that it's probably in the coyote fox family.
Later, we see a similar X in some smaller footprints crossing a log.
We have a fox.
Levine can't find enough clues to say for sure whether it was a gray fox or a red fox, but she says uncertainty is part of tracking, too.
I don't want to just figure out what animal it is. That's just one question. It's what the animal did.
She says that's what's really interesting. For VPR News, I'm Susan Keyes.
And you can find a link to more information about Lynn Levine's books on tracking at our website, vpr.net. And that's it for our program today. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel's guests will be House Education Committee Chair Joey Donovan and Senate Education Committee Chair Dick McCormick. They'll discuss a plan to consolidate school districts and talk about the legislature's reaction to the almost three dozen school budgets that were defeated, on town meeting day. And you can email your questions or comments about that to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. And on Monday, Jane Lindholm is back on the job. I've had a great time filling in for her during her maternity leave and have loved getting to work with the incredible Vermont Edition staff, which includes producers Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. Tim Johnson provided production assistance today. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.